There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
To Off the Hour CKUT's Community News Program. This is the Friday edition and it's November 13th, 2009. On this edition of the program, we'll hear about the Vancouver-based Pacific Rim Mining Corporation. In this segment, researcher and anti-mining activist William Castillo responds to questions about the National Coalition Against Mineral Mining, the challenges and successes in the movement against mining, and what Canadians should know about Pacific Rim's lawsuit against the Central American country El Salvador. But first, we turn to global climate change. We hear an interview with Jim Hogan, who is co-founder of the blog daysmogblog.com, and co-author of the new book Climate Cover-Up, which uncovers the greed and selfishness of the climate change denial industry. So stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Every time I go uptown, them bones gonna rise again. Those businessmen, they knock me down, them bones gonna rise again. And I knowed it, indeed I knowed it, brother, I knowed it. Ooh, them bones gonna rise again. That's it. In the middle of the night, them bones gonna rise again. I dreamed a dream with all my might, them bones gonna rise again. And I know. noted, noted. Indeed, I noted, brother, I noted. Ooh, them bones gonna rise again. Well, every time I look around, them bones gonna rise again. The cops are beating somebody down, them bones gonna rise again. But I noted, noted. Indeed, I noted, brother, I noted. Ooh, them bones gonna rise again. Them bones gonna rise again. Went out last night in People's Park. Them bones gonna rise again. Danced and made love in the dark. Them bones gonna rise again. And I noted, noted. Indeed, I noted, sister, I noted. Wee, them bones gonna rise again. Them bones gonna rise. You plant the seed and watch it grow. Them bones gonna rise again. How it ends, you'll never know. Them bones gonna rise again. And I noted, noted. Indeed, I noted, sister, I noted. Whoo! Them bones gonna rise again. Them bones gonna rise again. Them bones gonna rise again. Them bones gonna rise again.
And our next speaker, please help me welcome Clifton Nicholas, a Mohawk community activist.
Sagal, globalized terrorism began in 1492 with the conquest of the Americas. Manifest Destiny was responsible for the genocide and ethnocide of indigenous people in the United States of America and in Canada, and it continues today in Iraq. My people have a word that we use to describe every American president since George Washington, and that is Ruthie Nusogeda, which means the village burner. And this is what George Bush is. He is a village burner. He's burning villages all over the Middle East and all over Iraq. Say no to the occupation. Say no to the occupation of indigenous land in Canada, the U.S. Yawa, Ona.
Let's go, fellas. Shout time's up in 5 minutes. That's it. 5 more minutes and that's it. Back to work, fellas. Back to work.
Yo, little Khadija pops his locks. She wanna pop the lock. My prison ain't nothing but a private stock. And she be dreaming about his date of release. She hate the police, but loved by her grandma who hugs and kisses her. Her father's a political prisoner, free Fred. Son of a panther that the government shot dead back in 12-4-1969. 4 o'clock in the morning, it's terrible but it's fine. Cause Fred Hampton Jr. looks just like him. Walks just like him, talks just like him. And it might be frightening the feds and the snitches to see him organize the gang, brothers and sisters. So he had to be framed, yo. You know how the game go, 18 years because the 5-0 said so. They said he set it fire to an A-Rap store, but he ignited the minds of the young, black, and poor. Behind enemy lines, my niggas are cellmates. Most of the youth never escape the jail fate. Super maximum camps will advance their game plan to keep us in the hands of the man locked up. Locked up.
Collect call from Ness.
How are you?
Yo, shit is crazy, boo.
Have you been all right?
Yo, I'm pushing money in my commissary.
Lil' Kenny been smoking Lucy since he was 12. Now he 25, locked up with a L. They call him Triple K, cause he killed 3 niggas. Another ghetto child got turned into a killer. His pops was a Vietnam veteran on heroin, used like a pawn by these white North Americans. Mama couldn't handle the stress and went crazy. Grandmama had to raise the baby, just a young boy, born to a life of poverty. Hustling, robbery, whatever brung the paper home. Carried the chrome like a blind man, hold a cane. Tattoos all over his chest so you could know his name. But y'all know how the game go. D's kicked in the front door and guess who they came for? A young nigga headed for the pen. Coulda been, shoulda been, never see the hood again.
Behind enemy lines, my niggas are cellmates. Most of the youth never escape the jail fate. Super maximum camps will advance their game plan to keep us in the hands of the man. Locked up behind enemy lines, my niggas are cellmates. Most of the youth never escape the jail fate. Super maximum camps will advance their game plan to keep us in the hands of the man. Locked up, locked up.
Cuando yo llamo, tú no me quieres escuchar. No he visto mis hijos, mi mujer, no me mandan retrato, no tengo dinero. Estoy aquí jodido en la cárcel, metido.
You ain't got to be locked up to be in prison. Look how we living. 30,000 niggas a day up in the bin. Standard routine, they put us in a box, just like our life on the block.
Behind enemies.
You ain't got to be locked up to be in prison. Look how we living. 30,000 niggas a day up in the bin. Standard routine, they put us in a box, just like our life on the block.
Behind enemy lines.
And welcome back to CKUT. This is Off the Hour. And this is, of course, CKUT's community news broadcast. And we're going to start our Friday edition today with a conversation with Jim Hogan. Are you on the line, Jim? Wait just 1 second. Jim, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, good. There we go. We got him now. So thanks for joining us, Jim. Now, of course... This is Jim Hogan we're going to be speaking with, and as I mentioned off the top of the show, there is a major United Nations climate conference coming up in Copenhagen in December, and our guest today on Off the Hour has written a recent book called Climate Cover-Up, and Climate Cover-Up offers compelling insights for anyone interested in learning why there is so much confusion about the climate change issue in the media. Jim Hogan is the co-founder of desmogblog.com. He's the president of James Hogan and Associates, which is a public relations firm based in Vancouver. And he's also the chair of the David Suzuki Foundation and a trustee of the Dalai Lama Center for Peace and Education. So welcome, Jim, to CKUT. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So let's get started right away. Lots to talk about with this compelling new book that you've released, that you've co-authored. And first, I just wanted to read a post that was made in response to a recent article about your book. It says, "The majority of this is just some random person writing online. The majority of scientists reject the human-caused global warming theory. The Earth is in its third decade of global cooling." And so on and so forth. The internet is absolutely rife with this kind of rhetoric when, as you say in your book, the science of climate change is unequivocally clear. The climate is warming and humans are to blame. How did people become so confused on this issue?
Well, I'm a PR guy. I've been in public relations about 30 years, and I started looking into this about 4 years ago. A little over 4 years ago, and I more or less kind of stumbled across it. We were planning on doing a kind of a public service page on our new website, and somebody came up with this idea, why don't we do something on climate change? It's so controversial. You know, people are overstating their position, so we could do a page that would, you know, point people to kind of correct information and sort out the rhetoric from the facts. So I naively said, sure, and then I just started to do some reading, and I was kind of stunned at how little controversy there actually was in the scientific literature compared to what there was in mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically, we started a blog called Desmog Blog, and mm-hmm. that's ended up in this book, Climate Cover-Up. And we decided to write the book because we thought people should be aware of this campaign. We call it a confusion campaign, and we have documented the evidence in the book of this coal and oil industry campaign that was designed to kind of attack climate science and confuse the public about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years of doing this research, we have found it really difficult to find a legitimate climate scientist who says that climate change isn't happening and that humans don't have something to do with it. Virtually every major scientific academy in the world says climate change is happening, humans are causing it, and it's serious.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look really closely at these people who say it's not happening, what we find is kind of people who are taking money from industry or people who are just kind of completely unqualified to be talking about climate science.
Well, I did want to ask you who exactly it is involved in this denial industry. Is it fossil fuel interests for the most part? Who exactly is involved with this counter-information campaign, if I can call it that?
Well, let me give you an example. The list is quite long, but in Canada, there's a group called the Friends of Science that is right now you can hear radio ads across the country confusing people about climate change. They along with the Fraser Institute in Canada, recently sponsored a couple of tours by people trying to say, basically, with this message that climate change isn't happening. But what these groups have in common is industry money and lack of expertise in the area. Even the people that they actually put on the podium are not climate scientists. Mm-hmm. And in the United States, it's a much bigger industry. There's in the early 90s, there was a group called the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition that was put together by the tobacco industry, mainly by Philip Morris, that evolved into away from just trying to defend tobacco against secondhand smoke regulation into an all-out war on science that involved not just tobacco, but also the energy industry. And so Exxon got involved in it and basically used the same kind of techniques that were used by tobacco, which I don't know if, well, you're probably too young to remember any of that, but when, you know, few decades back in the 80s, tobacco was basically trying to argue that there wasn't any scientific evidence that linked tobacco with cancer or secondhand smoke with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And once that argument stopped working, they decided instead that they would set up a separate group. We called their group or this type of group an AstroTurf group, like a fake grassroots mm-hmm. group. They set these groups up, populated them with scientists who were willing to defend tobacco or, you know, the oil industry and attack science for money, and basically had these scientists out speaking on behalf of this AstroTurf group to try and convince people that the science was uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
Same message with tobacco that they used with climate change, or they are using with climate change. So that was the kind of birth of this technique, this what you might call a war on science.
Mm-hmm.
But similar things have been going on. Groups have been set up by the American Petroleum Institute in the States, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute.
Mm-hmm.
There's a group called Americans for Clean Coal Electricity. They recently spent $40 million on a clean coal campaign. And so the list is very long, but these are basically industry front groups or fake grassroots groups that have scientists for hire going out trying to convince the public that there's more doubt about the science around climate change than there actually is. It's essentially an industry effort to block good public policy on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and it's working.
Yeah. Now, just today, Reuters reported yet another sign of a warming planet. Twice as many record high temperatures in the United States as record lows over the last decade. A parallel study of temperatures in Australia showed about the same results over the same period. Yet we still hear from the likes of Rex Murphy, Margaret of the CBC, Margaret Wendt in the Globe and Mail. Rex Murphy writes for the Globe and Mail as well. And many others, in fact, in the media, of course, the National Post is quite renowned for this, insisting that the climate has, in fact, stopped warming since 1998 and that there's not much to be worried about at all. Now, you talk in your book about how the media has basically been complicit in promoting the views of climate skeptics. Can you give us some examples of this and explain why the media has been so willing to play along?
Well, I mean, I think you just gave some good examples. Rex Murphy is a great example of basically someone who's, you know, more influenced by his own ideology than he is by the science. I mean, this sort of cavalier, irresponsible, contrary attitude that he takes towards this is just kind of stunning.
Mm-hmm.
He clearly has not read the file, and I think what he's doing is completely irresponsible, very foolish. And I think, you know, he should read this book and then kind of change his attitude, because clearly the science is solid on this. And he wrote an article just recently that was so humorous. He basically was quoting a weatherman from the BBC and treating him like he was some kind of major climate scientist. Mm-hmm. The thing that I find amazing about these reports is it's not so much that people have this kind of alternate point of view, which of course they're entitled to, but actually trying to, that they struggle so hard to try and find some kind of scientific basis for it. There really isn't a scientific basis for this view that climate change isn't a problem. There's a woman who did a very impressive piece of research, I think it was about 10 years ago, looking at the scientific literature and seeing how much of a debate was actually taking place in the scientific literature. And she reviewed 1,000 articles, and she couldn't find one that was saying that climate change wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. Her name was Naomi Oreskes. It's a very famous piece of research that was published in Science.
Yeah, but at the same time, columnists and so on who are promoting this point of view, they seem to already have an opinion, and then they just find the odd study or so-called scientist who will support their viewpoint. Yet publications such as the Globe and Mail and others are respectable publications who are printing this stuff. Now I'm certainly not in any favor of any kind of censorship, but isn't there some responsibility on behalf of news outlets as well?
Yeah, well, I would. Rex Murphy is a columnist, you know, so he's entitled to his own opinion. But I think this is, you know, beyond kind of foolish and irresponsible. So, you know, you would think that there is some kind of responsibility that they should take for this. But it's not just the Globe and Mail; it's the Washington Post. I think this is one of the problems that the media has today: is when you feel like it's your right as a media outlet to just let anyone say whatever for effect, you know, and then people just gradually lose respect for the credibility of the media outlet over time. And I think that's one of the problems that the media is facing these days, and why newspapers are becoming less and less popular, mm-hmm. is because, you know, we're kind of bombarded by all this nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Let me take the devil's advocate position here for a moment and argue that isn't skepticism a healthy thing? Isn't it good for science to have skeptics? I mean, there have been times throughout history when the broad weight of scientific opinion has been wrong on occasion. Is it possible that the science is wrong on climate change?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that skepticism is the essence of science. But scientists actually debate science. There's actually a way that you do that in peer-reviewed journals. What you see from these folks, like there's a famous fellow named Christopher Monckton, the Lord Christopher Monckton, who's been touring across Canada speaking about climate change not being a problem over the last few months, sponsored by the Fraser Institute and the Friends of Science. But this guy is not a scientist, but he's on national television. He's speaking in venues across the country, but he's not a climate scientist, and he's not actually doing climate science. So this is so that's what you're dealing with. On one hand, is this kind of just media controversy, but if you actually look in the scientific literature, where these scientific debates and this skepticism should be taking place, there it's not taking place,
mm-hmm.
and that's because a lot of this is settled already. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are questions around climate change and how serious it's going to be and what, you know, the timing of it and all these other kinds of issues that are being looked at and are kind of yet to be determined. But there isn't a lot of scientific controversy about whether or not it's actually happening. So I say, you know, if you're a scientist and you take issue with whether or not climate change is actually happening, why is it that you're actually not raising that issue in peer-reviewed journals like other scientists?
Mm-hmm. Are there any climate scientists who are considered skeptics, legitimate climate scientists?
There's a handful, two, maybe three. And
out of hundreds or thousands?
Out of thousands and thousands, yes.
Okay.
And they're very difficult to find, and usually if you find these, I don't call them skeptics, I call them climate change deniers.
Okay.
But usually if you find them, they are in some way connected with industry, taking money from industry either directly or indirectly.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this is all about, is it simply money and big business that feels threatened by this? Or is there something more transformative at stake here in terms of how our society and an economy will have to change if we really want to grapple with the climate and energy crises? Is that what scares people, do you think?
I think that's in part true. You know, I think that there are a lot of people who are participating. Like, I would never suggest that Rex Murphy's taking money from the oil industry. He's not. But he's a certain kind of ideologue that is, you know, passionately of a certain perspective and argues from that ideological perspective, that kind of free market perspective. And I think these people either, you know, unconsciously or consciously have kind of fallen into bed with these other folks that I'm talking about who are on the payroll of the energy industry, who are really being paid to create confusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they are in bed with them because they are ideologically of a certain mind, and that is they, you know, they're opposed to government control of these types of problems or government intervention in these types of problems. And there's no question there'll have to be big change. Shifting from dirty energy to clean energy does involve big change.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can understand why industry would be concerned and resisting it.
One final question for Jim Hogan, co-founder of the great blog, desmogblog.com, which is very well worth checking out, as well as his new book, Climate Cover-Up. Now, Jim, we are on the eve of the Copenhagen Climate Summit, in which nations will be trying to reach a new international treaty on global CO2 emissions to replace the expiring Kyoto Agreement. Now, even if climate change becomes worse, as scientists expect, and we see more and more disasters, skeptics will continue to say that it's all an entirely natural process, presumably. Given this, what are your prospects for a deal in Copenhagen, given the PR and all the confusion surrounding the issue?
I think the most significant thing that's going to come out of Copenhagen is a reaction by civil society against the failure of governments to come up with binding targets, greenhouse gas emission targets, and some kind of binding agreement that requires countries around the world to regulate reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. With the failure of that kind of an agreement, you're going to see a very, what I think is going to be a very positive thing, where you're going to get especially young people saying that a lot of these old folks who are failing to actually do something about this problem because of their, you know, because of their political situation and their fear of the oil and gas industry, you're going to get a lot of young people reacting to that and saying, okay, you couldn't solve it, we're going to solve it. And I think the sooner that happens, the better. I mean, we need to be on the streets in Washington and Ottawa demanding change on this issue, because it is by far and away the most serious environmental issue that humans have ever faced. And we can't be sitting back doing nothing about it. Politics as usual is not what we want out of Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm. Great. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks again, Jim Hogan, author of Climate Cover-Up. Now, you're going to be in Montreal, I think, on November 23rd. Is that right?
Yes.
You're speaking at Concordia?
Yes.
Okay. Now, is that on a book tour? Or?
Yes. It'll all be talking about the book.
Okay, great. So people in the Montreal area listening, of course, you can catch up with Jim and ask more questions in person to him about his work and the most recent book. But again, I want to thank you for joining us, and all the best. Again, the name of the blog is desmogblog.com. Thanks very much, Jim.
Thank you.
Bye. With our programming on CKUT, we're going to be going now to a couple ads, I think.
Yeah.
Or not. Just to let you know, it is now almost 5:30 on your Friday evening. You're listening to CKUT, and this is, of course, the community news program Off the Hour. And I'm here, this is Mark, with Vanessa and David in studio with us. Vanessa, what do we have coming up next?
Well, we have now the weather check. So tonight, actually, now it's 8 degrees, some clouds in Montreal, and it's expected for tonight 3 degrees and a couple showers tomorrow in the afternoon. The average of weather is 7 degrees. So, so stay tuned, and you are listening to Off the Hour, breaking all corporate and state-created sound barriers on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. To reach Montreal's Community News Collective or to get involved, call 448-4041, extension 6788. That's 514-448-4041, extension 6788. We'll be right back.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
I like CKUT because of all the different music programming and how it brings together lots of different kinds of people under one roof.
Yeah, man.
Why do you like the radio so much?
CKUT is great because they let you volunteer and get involved and eventually have your own radio show.
Okay. Yeah, man.
Why do you like CKUT so much?
I like it because it is open to all kinds of ideas, and it's all kinds of music, all kinds of people exchanging ideas and knowledge and information about music, and we put out programming that doesn't exist anywhere else in the city, and that's pretty radical.
Yeah, man.
Oh, baby.
Folks back east, they say, is leaving home every day, beating the hot old dusty way to the California line. Across the desert sands they roll, getting out of that old dust bowl. They think they're going to a sugar bowl, but here's what they find. Now the police at the port of entry say, you're number 14,000 for today. Oh, if you ain't got the do-re-mi.
Welcome back to Off the Hour. You are listening to CKUT 19.3 FM in Montreal. Next up, we hear about the Vancouver-based Pacific Rim Mining Corporation. In this segment, researcher and anti-mining activist William Castillo responds to questions about the National Coalition Against Mineral Mining, the challenges and successes in the movement against mining, and what Canadians should know about Pacific Rim's lawsuit against the Central American country, El Salvador.
This is Charlie Oak reporting for CKUT Radio, and I'm here with Emily Carpenter.
Hello.
And William Castillo.
Hola.
I'll be working with Emily to record an interview in Spanish and English with William Castillo, who is visiting from El Salvador as a representative of the Center for Research on Investment and Trade, part of a national coalition against mineral mining in El Salvador. And so to begin with, William, could you please introduce yourself and describe the work you do in El Salvador?
Bueno, mi nombre es William Castillo.
My name is William Castillo, and I am part of a space of resistance in El Salvador that is called the National Coalition Against Mineral Mining.
Frente a la minería metálica.
For people living in Canada and listening to this interview, what do these people need to know about the situation in El Salvador?
Bueno, la Mesa Nacional frente a la minería metálica está resistiendo.
So the National Table on Mining in El Salvador is resisting a series of attempts by Canadian companies to develop mines in El Salvador, and especially in this moment when the Salvadoran government is being sued by a Canadian company.
Este espacio lo constituyen organizaciones.
The coalition is made up of environmental organizations, of religious organizations, and also of base social organizations.
Y organizaciones también de base social.
And in mineral mining, in the exploitation of minerals, we see a threat not only to the environment, but also against the lives of people. And for that reason, we have put ourselves in opposition to, and we are in opposition to, the installation of mineral mines in the country. Despite the great economic power that these mining companies represent. But we are sure that we will win because the position that we have is just, it is dignified, and most of all, it has to do with defending the right to live.
I hope you could share some stories from the past about challenges and successes in the struggles you've been working with through.
Mm-hmm. So the movement has been marking specific events over a rather short time that the struggle against mining has been happening in El Salvador. In 2003, when permits were first given to the mining companies, no one really knew what the projects consisted of. So at that point, the movement began a campaign of information, of research, and also of consciousness raising about the issue in El Salvador. And then after that, we moved into a phase that was more about the confrontation between people who were pro-mining and the anti-mining movement in El Salvador. So these confrontations took place in the communities. They also took place through radios, TV, the press, and all of these mediums, including forums and debates where we were face-to-face with mining companies. And there was also, at times, direct confrontation between people who supported the mines, who were people who were employed by the mining company, and people who were against the mine, which also at times included direct violence. Among those, you can count the loss of two fingers of an activist who was against the mine in an attack by a promoter of the mining company. And another event where someone who was an anti-mining activist was arrested for their activities. And in July of this year, we also add to this list the kidnapping, torture, and murder of an anti-mining activist, Marcelo Rivera. And then the other act, or the last act that I'll tell you, is that there was an anti-mining activist who was shot and by a miracle is still alive today. And the third phase of this whole movement has been the different social sectors of the society taking a position on mining. So the Catholic Church, the productive industrial sectors of the country, the environmentalist sectors of the country, development organizations, and also government representatives from both the right and the left have all declared themselves opposed to mining. And the last part of this story is that the mining companies have brought a lawsuit against the government of El Salvador in response to the government not granting them mining exploitation permits. This is the moment where we find ourselves right now, and for that reason we want the Canadian people to know about the injustice that is the lawsuit Pacific Rim has brought against El Salvador and against the Salvadoran people. El Salvador is a poor country, and it will affect El Salvador very strongly if they need to pay compensation through this lawsuit. We also want to denounce that the Canadian company Pacific Rim is suing El Salvador by way of a trade agreement that isn't signed between Canada and El Salvador, but rather between the United States and El Salvador, and that trade agreement is CAFTA, and this is not a legitimate suit for that reason. They're using a subsidiary in the United States in order to take advantage of a resource that does not even correspond to them, which is CAFTA. We think that this is an injustice that can be stopped if the people of Canada are able to, if the people of Canada will pressure their government and their companies to withdraw the lawsuit.
We have a few minutes left for a few more questions, and I hope you could talk a little bit about your visit here to Montreal, as well as the tour that's been going on, and also for people listening and who are interested, where might they go for more information about issues of mining in El Salvador?
So the purpose of our visit to Canada is primarily to give information to people about the problems that we're facing with the threat of mineral mining in El Salvador. But it's also because we were just received a prize. We received the Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Award, which was given by the Institute for Policy Studies, recognizing the work and the importance of our work for human rights in El Salvador. And also with our presence here, we hope that this will add to the hope that we will win in this struggle and that we are, through collaborating with sister organizations here in Canada, that we are assuring that Pacific Rim will withdraw their suit. And so this is happening through work together with our sister organizations in Canada, such as Sister Cities and Salvade, which is in Ottawa.
Para más gente, para el pueblo de Canadá, y esto es muy importante para nosotros.
Is there anything you would like to add in conclusion?
Just a thank you for the opportunity to be heard by more people, by the people of Canada, that this opportunity is very important for us.
I've been speaking with William Castillo with the help of Emily Carpenter. I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with me today, and congratulations on the award you received. The recognition is very much deserved, I am sure. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gracias por todo.
Welcome back. This is Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and you just heard Stevie Wonder, Fingertips. Mark, what do you have next?
Thanks, Vanessa. Yeah, so continuing with our climate change theme for this show, of course, as the world prepares for the Copenhagen Climate Summit in December, we are being joined now on the line by Felix von Geyer and Grace Barrasso, who are actively following the developments taking place around the world as nations try to come together next month in Copenhagen to forge a new climate agreement to replace the expiring Kyoto Protocol. Felix von Geyer is a sustainable development journalist specializing in climate change politics. He also gives a course at Concordia called Energy, Power, and Security. Grace Barrasso is an independent sustainability entrepreneur based in Montreal. She is also a lecturer at Concordia in the Department of Geography, teaches a course on environmental impact assessment, and blogs regularly on carbon markets, climate change, and sustainability issues. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us, and we got about 15 minutes here to the end of the show, so we'll try to cover as much material as we can if you can keep your responses as succinct as possible. Let's start with you, Felix. Can you give us a quick update on the current status of the international negotiations?
Well, I think it's a case of it won't be wonderful, wonderful Copenhagen. It might be more let's go down Mexico way, because I cannot see getting a science-based target agreed on an international basis at Copenhagen, looking at what's going on in the States and elsewhere, really.
Mm-hmm. So is it? There has been a lot of discussion then, Felix, about the fact that there may not be a deal reached at all in Copenhagen. Is that what you see happening?
Yeah, I think you might get sort of the dots on some of the I's and crosses on some of the T's when it comes to further financial disbursements, working out where the reduced emissions from deforestation and avoided forest degradation might go. But there's still too many things like the legal architecture, such as enforceability, what the future of the Kyoto Protocol will be. This is a big issue for developed countries and developing countries. So, I think we're pretty much where we were in some respects on the major issues where we were in Bali.
Now, Grace Barrasso, you've written quite extensively about legislation, climate change legislation going through the U.S. Now, of course, the U.S. and China are considered the two key players, really, to make a deal at Copenhagen. Are we going to see any climate change legislation in the U.S. before next month?
Well, the pundits at the moment are very skeptical that the U.S. will emerge with any clear legislation before Copenhagen. It appears that they're really busy trying to put together their health reform packages, which is really at the top of the agenda. So as Canada tends to lead what the U.S. is tending to do as regards the current issues on climate change, it is very likely that Canada will also be entering the discussion in Copenhagen with very little on its plate as well.
Well, let's talk about that. You've been critical of Canada's position on this issue. What is it? Is Canada just playing a wait-and-see game here to see what the U.S. does first, or there is some kind of ideological stumbling block that Canada can't seem to get past on in terms of the climate change issue?
I think it's a combination of both. In North America, climate change is really divided amongst ideological lines between the left and the right, whereas in Europe, for example, these are just issues that they need to come to grips with, and they are handling it quite well. I mean, it was Angela Merkel who started a number of climate change institutes, such as the Potsdam Center, Margaret Thatcher with the Hadley Center on Climate Change. So these are issues that are being confronted by all political parties in Europe, but in North America, it's really seen as an issue of the left, and it's really attempting to be sabotaged by Republicans and to a certain extent by the conservatives in Canada.
Yeah, it is most unfortunate how it has become a political issue associated with sort of, as you say, left-leaning parties, and whereas conservative parties or the Republicans in the U.S. have been identified as those less willing to take action on climate change. So there's a major rift there between left and right, and of course there's a rift between developed and developing countries. Now, Felix, you wrote an article recently saying that until major developing countries agree to binding targets, the U.S. is unlikely to pass any meaningful emissions reductions targets. And
well, this is very true. And the problem is that, the major developing countries have to ultimately address their emissions. 85% of future emissions by 2050 will be coming from developing countries. We all know this. At the same time, they have to address their poverty. So they've decided to take the Western industrial economic model as their development path, which is perhaps not the path they should be thinking about. You know, headline ideas of growth economics rather than maybe working out better distribution. But that's what we have at the moment. And frankly, if they took sector-based targets, that would probably actually seal the carbon leakage gap, as I think I said last time I was on your show.
That's right.
Because then it stops the fossil the heavy carbon-based industries such as coal mining, coal-fired power generation, et cetera, from saying, look, if we are carbon-constrained and they're not carbon-constrained, then they basically are going to produce a cheaper product which is actually more carbon intense than we are. We may as well shut up shop and go and operate over there. But at the same time, that's a bit of a false excuse, and there's an awful lot more that can be done. Grace is actually quite right in what she's saying about this ideological issue. The United States at the moment has this big issue that, it says it can't get anything meaningful in terms of an emissions reduction target through the Congress because, while you need 60 Democratic senators for a majority on this, 16 Democratic senators are actually in coal-fired states. And so they're not going to say, let's have a meaningful emissions reduction target. For an international treaty, you need 67 people to pass that, which means you've got to get that gang of 16 plus 7 Republican senators. It's probably easier to get the 7 Republican senators, I should think. But so, there are things that can be done. Like you can actually probably put the cap and trade bill through the budgetary process where you actually need 51 votes, in fact. You could probably argue that it's a tax, as everybody in America thinks cap and trade is a tax, you know. But it's also interesting because America is also hiding behind this. They've always wanted a trade treaty in any case. Nothing's changed since the Bush administration. The U.S. national interest is U.S. national interest. And so they want that trade treaty to get the intellectual property stuff for things like advanced biofuels on, say, algae, etc. And there we have it. And Canada is hiding behind the fact of we can't do anything until the U.S. starts to do something. When, in fact, if we look at Australia, in fact, Canada could do an awful lot more. So it's really mendacity, I think, from Ottawa.
Well, that's it. It seems to be this sort of game of chicken between developing and developing and developed countries. You have the president of the Maldives saying that, criticizing nations, especially developed nations, for saying that they're not going to do anything until somebody else acts first. You know, it's sort of, and he called it a suicide pact. So, either of you, I mean, how do we get past this impasse? Any ideas how this is going to be resolved?
Well, if I can perhaps make a comment, I think that one of the things that will eventually emerge from Copenhagen is that we're really going to have a shift between the old guard, that is, you know, the gray-haired folks attending Copenhagen, and the younger generation, you know, who are really taking to heart much more the whole climate change issue. And as a result, the pressure that they will be, civil society, the pressure that they will be putting on governments because of their obstructionist stance at the moment, the way Canada is behaving, will increase dramatically. And it will really, I think it will force, in our situation, the Canadian government to respond much more rapidly to the demands being generated by not just environmental groups, but by the community overall. I mean, you know, the province of Quebec is taking leadership action. We have a lot of action that is being also being done on the municipal level. The city of Blainville is going ahead with plans on looking at renewable energy, particularly when it comes to geothermal energy. So there's a lot of stuff going on the local and municipal level. And unfortunately, we're lacking really the leadership on a federal level.
So, Grace Barrasso, do you think that is where we're going to see significant action taking place, if not internationally? Will it be the provinces and municipalities picking up the slack?
Well, this is what is going on at the moment. But from an industry point of view, industry would really like to see action being done on a federal level. I mean, if you have 10 operating facilities in different provinces, does that mean that you're going to be having 10 different types of regulatory regimes? And this creates an uneven level playing field for the business community. And therefore, I think it is important that the federal government come up with a clear, concise plan on a federal level that is coordinated, yes, with the United States, but is also in tune with potential future emissions trading legislation done on an international scale.
What are Canadian businesses calling for then? If I can paint them with such a broad swath, are businesses calling upon the federal government to regulate greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes, there's a lot of the manufacturing sector in particular is calling on the Canadian government to come up with a clear plan. There is a difference between the oil and gas industry and larger manufacturing. So there are two different positions on the Canadian level. In the United States, for example, there is the U.S. cap, which is really calling on the federal government to come up with federal legislation. We have now what is cropping up, all these different regional initiatives, for example, the Western Climate Initiative, where you have a number of Western states and the province of Quebec, for example, lumping into one forum. And there's all these types of piecemeal initiatives cropping up all over the place, and it's not exactly the best business environment to operate in. So industry wants to have clear mandates, clear legislation, in order for them to get on with the show, essentially.
Now, just this week, the International Energy Agency released its latest World Energy Outlook. Now, this is a not exactly a biased organization, a pretty nonpartisan as they come, and their report stated that the world faces a surge in energy costs as well as in planet warming carbon emissions unless it can swiftly agree to a climate change deal. Without an international agreement, the ratio of energy spending to gross domestic product for the largest consumer countries would double by 2030. So this is, you know, the dire warnings that we continue to hear from different organizations, really. Felix von Geyer, what do you think the prospects for success are here? I mean, the targets, many scientists think that the targets being proposed aren't even ambitious enough.
Well, I think 450 is, well, put it this way, if climate has responded in a way that scientists weren't actually expecting, we're only at 387. I think trying to talk about stabilization at 450 isn't good enough.
So this is parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere.
Parts per million of sort of carbon dioxide equivalent.
So we're at 387 now, did you say?
Sorry?
What are we at right now?
Around 387.
Okay, and there's...
And so we're talking about sort of stabilizing at 450.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of people are thinking that already we're at the point that we're not going to actually keep it below 2 degrees in any case.
2 degrees warming.
Yeah, 2 degrees warming. And that's fairly frightening. And as I say, scientists are already surprised by the effects they're already seeing at that level. So it takes me back to the very first conversation I had with Rajendra Pachauri, the chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, when I said, look, most scientists actually are projecting far worse than the IPCC report. And he said, well, that's the benefit of us. We're a conservative organization. When we say something, people start to listen. But, yeah, you're possibly right. The wildcard scenarios are probably more accurate. Mm-hmm. And I think we could be heading that way. And that's what the IEA report said, that if we continue on this energy path, we're going to be going through 6 degrees. And if you read Mark Linus's book on what happens if you go through 6 degrees, it's a very frightening scenario indeed. You can start to kiss bye to humanity in probably far less than 1,000 years, which is not a very intelligent scenario for most intelligent species on the planet.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's interesting. The other interesting thing about the IEA report is how it underplayed the peak oil debate. And it does make me wonder at what point energy scarcity is going to actually start to make people fuel more money towards renewable energies in any case.
Quickly, Felix, prospects for success. If there's no deal in Copenhagen, where do we go from here? People mentioned the Obama factor as being a key wild card in this, and he might be able to pull something out if he shows up. But barring that, if there's failure in Copenhagen, what happens next?
Well, it's a case of, do you call it failure? I mean, we're talking about a post-2012 framework, so arguably, did it have to be agreed by December in Copenhagen? I don't know if you could actually call it failure. But I think it's, in some respects, it is failure because it's an urgent discussion. It's really a sprint race without a finishing line. It's not a marathon at all. It's a sprint race without a finishing line. And, hopefully, a lot of public pressure will start to swing things. But I think you've got to understand with the American position, you've got to frame it in their general overall idea of national security at the moment. Ever since Paul Kennedy wrote the rise and fall of the great superpowers, America's had to think about, does it have to manage its decline as a superpower gradually? There was a National Intelligence Commission report some months ago saying that the U.S. would peak as a kind of superpower by 2025, and Michael Clare recently, the author of things like Resource Wars and Blood and Oil, was saying that actually America's probably already peaked. Mm-hmm. As a